Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Charlie Lee Potter has had a lifelong passion for working with sound, especially in creatively weaving soundscapes to evoke places. As a former BBC radio journalist and foreign correspondent, she knows how the sound of a place helps to tell complicated stories and has applied this to a fascinating series of podcasts she's recorded on walks called Inside a Mountain. However, there's a lot more to Charlie than just working with sound, as I discover on a walk we take across Christchurch Meadows in Oxford.
Let's start a little bit. Tell us a little bit about Inside a Mountain.
Well, first of all, I should probably say why it's called Inside a Mountain. I mean, in some ways, I found it quite satisfying, because if you write it down, Inside a Mountain, it actually states with the first letters of each word, I am. So there's very much a sort of philosophical bent to it, a sense of asserting yourself or placing yourself in the landscape. But the key reason for the phrase Inside a Mountain is it's a phrase that the wonderful Cairngorms writer Nan Shepherd used in her book The Living Mountain, which I'm sure you've read. She touched on something which absolutely cuts to the heart of what I do when I'm walking and when I'm recording sound and when I'm interviewing people about creativity and kind of creating soundscapes around that creativity. By saying that a mountain has an inside, what she was really suggesting was that when we go for walks, you know, it can be very tempting to say, I've gone the furthest, I've gone the fastest, I've climbed to the top, I'm in charge, look at me, I'm on the summit, I am in command. And actually she said we should run counter to exactly that and be more kind of humble in our walking. So she says in the book, the talking tribe, I find, wants sensation from the mountain, not in Keats's sense. Beginners not unnaturally do the same. I did myself. They want the startling view, the horrid pinnacle, sips of beer and tea instead of milk. Yet often the mountain gives itself most completely when I have no destination, when I reach nowhere in particular, but have gone out merely to be with the mountain. And I think that's absolutely what cuts to the heart of what I'm doing with my podcast. I'm not saying we did 20 miles and, oh, it was tough, but we managed it. It's just walking as thinking, walking as creativity, walking as a means of evoking place, not specifically aiming to get to somewhere.
Well, I want to get back to the evoking place, because I think actually that's at the heart of what you do, but you do so much. I wonder how you ever get time to make a podcast.
They do take a very long time to make, because the soundscape is so complex and so woven. You know, often I might have 5, 6, 7 sound effects going on at once as a way of evoking place. But to be honest with you, although it takes ridiculous amounts of time, which I don't really have, there's something so creative about being specific about place merely via sound. I mean, if you think of a writer like Virginia Woolf, for example, so evocative when she's describing water of all different kinds, but clearly needs to take quite a few words in each instance in order to do that. Several lines, several sentences to say, for example, you know, that wonderful, tight, elastic glossiness that you get on the sea early morning when there's no wind, or that kind of chattering noise that you might have listening to a mountain stream. They're all words, kind of accretive words, which somehow build to a sense ultimately in the reader's mind of what she's talking about. If I record the sound of that sea at 5 o'clock in the morning, or that brook at 6 o'clock in the evening on a summer's evening, I don't need to say anything more, because the sound itself makes that place exist in the creative mind of the listener. So I'm kind of asking the listeners to do some stuff. You know, I want them to do some work for this. It's not just a loll back and have a joplet. You know, it's kind of be alert to it. And yet, but it does take a very long time.
So there are 5 episodes. I mean, one thing that I thought was kind of interesting were they were of different duration. they became more sophisticated as the series went on. And I thought from a, you know, someone seasoned in radio production, I was feeling this is kind of strange, because I thought it was almost like someone learning their way through while they were doing it. And yet, no, this can't be right, because you've made so many different programmes yourself already. Radio is sort of in your blood.
It is in my blood. What I realised with the podcast, though, is, you know, when I was making programmes for Radio 4, you know, they had to be 27 minutes long. That's it. They had to fit. And there was no way around that. But actually, certainly when it came to the Marcus de Soto example, that's an infinitely longer episode than maybe, say, the first one with Sally Bailey, the writer Sally Bailey. But it's because I just realised I could please myself. And Marcus and I had a much longer walk, and Marcus and I had a lot of ground to cover. We were talking about strange loops, we were talking about the Ulipo group, we were talking about sonnets. And I thought, actually, there's 50 minutes here, I'll put out 50 minutes. And that is the glory of a podcast. You can make it what you wish it to be, because it's your creation. And the same with the international cellist Natalie Klein.
That was a lovely piece. I really thought that was I really enjoyed that. And I thought that the recordings you recorded of her were fabulous. I thought it was really lovely.
I'm glad you did. I mean, she's a remarkable woman, but she speaks with such poetry about her art. And there's a wonderful phrase that she uses at the end of that particular episode. When I ask her about, you know, what is it about that rhythm of the walk and the thud of the foot on the ground and the sense of being rooted in the ground as a musician trying to express landscape musically. And she said, when I play the cello, I have my feet firmly in the ground like a tree. And she said, that way my arms can be free. Again, thinking of that kind of tree motif. But she said, but then, you know, then my head, my imagination is free to roam. So beautiful evocation of landscape, but actually with her as the tree itself. And it was very powerful.
I think it was that one, or it may have been the one in which you interviewed, was it Kate Kennedy?
Kate Kennedy, yes.
Who'd written about Ivor Gurney. And you said how you entered a different imagination when you were out on a walk.
It's a different kind of psychic space that goes on when you're out on a walk, and I think one's thoughts are arranged in different ways. I mean, actually, Marcus de Soto said something not dissimilar, that it's in the act of moving that somehow all those disparate little fragments of ideas kind of coalesce and form a shape, and you sort of walk them into existence, I think was the phrase that I used. And I do very much think that in the process of walking, which is why I don't particularly care about walking from a place to a place. It's the walking, not the destination, which is provocative, I think.
Are there more Inside a Mountain podcasts to come?
There's one about to come, which is with Tom Chivers. We spent the day together walking around London and excavating London's past, and indeed Tom's own past to a degree, a couple of weeks ago, so the episode is going out this weekend.
No, you can't say that.
Why?
Because the book that I'm reading at the moment is Tom Chivers' London Clay.
It is this absolutely wonderful piece of scholarship, but it's just written in the most exquisite lyrical way. So it's that wonderful combination of huge depth of information, but this kind of beautiful, lyrical, responsive touch to it at the same time. I think it's wonderful.
OK, so why have you chosen the subjects you chose?
They're all people who have some kind of connection to the idea of moving across landscape and, in doing so, in being creative. Because that's what I find most fascinating, that in the process of the movement, there the ideas come. And all those people that I've interviewed so far, Sally Bailey, whose beautiful book, Girl with Dove, is a sort of exploration of her imagination, really. We kind of move through her imagination. So it's an imaginary walk in a funny kind of way. And then Anna Koska, the botanical artist from Devon. That was a great episode to make, because Anna's a hugely keen sea swimmer, which I am so not. I love the sea. I want to be standing by it, looking at it. But Anna loves wild swimming, so we had a very funny time recording that episode. It was freezing. She was in a little bikini, and off she strides into the sea. And, of course, I'm there with all my recording equipment. I've got my headphones on. I've got a handheld mic. I've got the recording device. And I didn't really have any choice but to just plunge in after her, but holding my arms above my head with all the equipment. And I was fully clothed. So I think big trousers, big boots, big coat. And then I drive back to Oxfordshire from Devon, where I'd interviewed her. in this soaking outfit. But I think that's the other thing that I do feel I should stress. I do think the potential for comedy needs to be seized when it comes along. So much is grim, so much is bleak. But if one can make sacrifices in the interest of comedy, that's fine by me. Well, same with the episode of Marcus the Stone Toy. You know, I wanted to run an experiment with him, because I'm always getting lost, because I don't have a destination. So I sent him off with bi-recording equipment, and he told us where we should end up meeting to see if I could find it. And so I recorded myself on my phone. And it was just hilarious, because wherever I turned, I seemed to just keep re-entering the marshes by the River Lee. So I had two full shoes of River Lee water by the end of recording, but it was very funny, so who cares? All to get that sound, fine by me.
You lecture and research literature here at Oxford.
I'm a lecturer in English literature.
Did that come before your radio
That came
experience?
After.
After.
What happened was, I wanted to work in radio because I wanted to work with sound. And a lot of those people who started at the BBC, which is where I worked for a long time, with me, they all wanted to work and be on the telly. And I did work, and I was on the telly. There's something so prescriptive about reporting television news or presenting news programmes. I sometimes presented breakfast news forever ago. There's something so constraining about the words that go with the television script. You know, you can't talk about, let's look over there. We've got some wonderful canal boats over there. I couldn't, in a television script, talk about those canal boats if I didn't have a picture of those canal boats. And if I did have footage of the canal boats, I wouldn't need to talk about the canal boats. So it automatically denudes the words that you're using and the atmosphere that you're creating of the creative possibilities that you might bring to it if I just recorded the sound of the water lapping up against those boats and the sound of the wind in the trees behind. So to me, radio reporting was... That was the life. I mean, it was... And in those days also, I was a reporter, a foreign correspondent for The World at One, The World This Weekend, the PM programme, and then went on to present the PM programme for quite a long time. The means of telling a story, often a really complex story, it was really valued as an exercise in how does the sound of the place help tell a really complicated story. It might have been a complicated story about the BSE crisis, for example, which affected us for so many years. You can actually tell that much better if you specify what's going on via the sound, and that might be the sound of some of the cattle being incinerated, as they were at the time of that crisis. All those things help to get across the heart of the science, but also that twinned aspect of the devastating impact it had on the people most closely involved. So those were glorious days, but after 20-something years, I actually decided I'd reinvent and do the thing which I ultimately had decided at the age of 21 that I was going to do, which was that I was going to be an academic working in English literature. So I stepped away from the BBC. Bold choice, but the right choice, and I embarked on a PhD while working as a writer to support the PhD. So when I emerged at the end of the PhD, I then started working in academia. And teaching literature is a huge privilege and to be defended. All those who maintain that the humanities are a luxury are, of course, completely and absolutely wrong, because it's the humanities, it's our engagement with literature, it's our understanding of literary texts at a really fine, granular level that actually makes us responsive human beings. So I will defend teaching literature to anybody and against anybody. So then, yes, a whole new career as academic. And I've got kind of stage three going on now, which is borrowing from those early days of working in radio for the podcast, but also combining that with work as an artist working with landscape art. So I'm on stage three.
I mean, you are a polymath. You're touching on all sorts of things. So I have no idea where you get the time to do everything you do. So tell us a little bit about ridge and furrow and embodied landscape and your interest in that.
Ridge and furrow, that medieval method of ploughing, I find fascinating conceptually. Because if you think about it, essentially, you know, the plough was digging down into the earth, lifting it and turning it over. So then the weeds that might have lain on the surface now are lying underneath. But if you look at the ridge and furrow in profile, what you have is a rather wonderful kind of triangular kind of open book. So in my mind, the landscape is a means of reading it, but also reading past, present, and potential future, to be honest. So I became very interested. I mean, I made a series of artist books, hugely long. One of them was about 20 feet long. Absolutely enormous. But the point being, not dissimilar in a way to the work that I want people to do in the nicest way when they're listening to my podcast. It was exhibited on the ground. And I actually want the observer to walk alongside the book. So they're going for a walk with the art, and it's only by walking its full length that they can fully understand what it portrays. And what it is, it's a series of prints, because printmaking is my particular thing. It was a series of prints of kind of roots and the messy mud at the ground level of plants, and then extending up towards the tip of plants in a wild site in Oxfordshire. So I then bent those prints two-thirds of the way along each one. So each print is one individual little part of the ridge and furrow. So there's endless sequences of them as it continues on its length. But if you walk in one direction alongside, companionably walking along with the art, you see the way the prints read all the roots. But if you turn around and you walk back the other way, you actually see the alternative surface of the ridge and furrow, which is the tips of the plant. So you literally are going for a walk with it, and you're encountering two different kinds of landscape as you do it. Couldn't make it inside because it's too big. So I had to go and make it outside on good days and then haul it back in and fold it up until I'd finished it.
With the ridge and furrow artwork, have you ever made a sound recording to go with it?
I did actually make a soundscape to go with it, because right at the beginning of the pandemic in this country, but before the first lockdown, I somehow, ridiculously, managed to get COVID and was extremely ill. It did very strange things to my mind. And for days and nights, I couldn't sleep, but I hardly knew where I was. Then as I started to get ever so slightly better, I still couldn't sleep and still felt very strange. But the dawn chorus was so piercingly loud at that time in March 2 years ago. And one night, it must have been, 4 in the morning, it just felt so dominant in my ears that I opened the skylight in my bedroom and I recorded the sound of the birds. If you take that recording, and if you slow it down, this is the glory of manipulating sound, if you slow it down, it takes on this extraordinary, uncanny, haunted quality. So it feels of nature, but you can't quite work out what it is. And so when I paired that with this very odd, readable artist's book, it actually produced something really combustible as a way of engaging with nature that you kind of knew what you're looking at, but you didn't fully. So you weren't in command of it. It was sort of in command of you.
You mentioned something about printmaking, and that printmaking was your love. So tell us a bit more about the printmaking.
So I like to etch copper with... basically, you put it in a bath of acid to get your lines, and then you wind it through a kind of printing press which looks a little bit like a mangle. So that's a kind of that's one element of etching, or I might produce a range of what are called photopolymer etchings. It's another process, but it's not dissimilar technique of paper squished into lines which have been inked up on a plate. And why I like intaglio, that etch, is because there's something really visceral about scoring your lines in your plate, however you do it. You could do it with a needle, or you could do it with acid, or you could do it with a photographic process in the darkroom. You etch in those lines, and then you crush in that paper. There's something really visceral about the contact between the two surfaces, which to me is a little bit like walking. Now, as we're walking now, we're kind of inscribing a pathway for ourselves in this sandy track in the park in Oxford, aren't we? And each individual footstep is making its kind of mark. So conceptually, that's why I love etching. But I also do quite like all that nerdy, you know, acid stuff and wearing your goggles and your big gloves. I quite like all that stuff.
So do you have a huge studio on hand at home, or do you have a, do you go or escape somewhere that has all this sort of kind of kit?
I have got a studio at home which has in it a very large mid-19th century printing press, which was my father's. He restored it. But that's more for relief printing. So if I'm doing etching, I mean, I'm not going to be tipping out big bottles of acid into buckets in, you know, in my back room. So I'm a member of what's called Oxford Printmakers, which is a printmaking workshop very close to where we are now, actually. So you can go and muddle about with acid to your heart's content there.
Brilliant, brilliant. OK, so of all these things, that are sort of, is there something you're aiming for at the end here?
There is a tendency, and I have it myself, which is to say that you go out into nature and somehow it acts as a sort of balm. It soothes. But I just have this kind of tension in my mind at the moment, which is that if we're constantly thinking that, we are still kind of co-opting nature for our purposes. We're saying, you know, isn't it lovely? Look at those green fields over there near Magdalen College. And the river's going past. Beautiful, and it's doing its job to help me. So I'm working on a research project which is trying to assess the extent to which actually we have to step aside. We have to no longer attempt to reign supreme over nature. So I'm thinking about the idea of future ruins and what constitutes the ruin. Is the ruin us, mankind? Or is the ruin nature itself? But, ironically, if nature is ruined, it's potentially wild. Therefore, it then is in the ascendancy. So I'm sort of considering all these questions in a research project which brings in printmaking and papermaking and engagement with surfaces and the way perhaps you can see through a surface. So both sides have equal weight, both sides have equal power, to see if I can explore some of those complex issues.
Can I ask you to recommend perhaps a couple of walks?
Well, I think I'm going to recommend a walk from my past and a walk from my present. And as for future walks, who knows? The past walk I'm going to choose is the ghostly village of Tynham in Dorset, which was commandeered by the War Office, what we now know as the MOD, in 1943. All the villagers were forced out and they were given a few pennies for the vegetables that were still growing in the ground. The understanding being they would be allowed back when the army had used it for their war training. But come 1948, they announced, actually, no, compulsory purchase, we're buying it, you can never come back. And I did meet a lovely old man once who had been a child in Tynham. And he was 80-something, and he still had such deep sadness and resentment that he was never allowed to go home. That said, it does make for the most magical walk, because you get there, it's the Jurassic coastline. It sits in the valley between two hills, two Purbeck hills, and the village itself still looks like a village, but it's one that's barely hanging together. All the houses are ruined, so it already has that really intense sort of haunted quality. Then you walk down through the woods, and if you go at the wild garlic time of year, the air is absolutely pulsating with the smell of garlic. Very beautiful. And then you walk down to the beach of Warbarrow Bay, and it's the only way you can get to it is from the ruined village of Tynham. You can't kind of budge yourself along there from another bit of the coastline, because it's protected by the hills either side. And it's the most exquisite beach, but it has that sort of, which I think I always do quite like, it has that kind of minor key throbbing underneath all the time of what went on and what was lost. So that's my past one, because that's my childhood growing up near there.
And that's something that you can only access when the MOD allow you in, isn't it?
Yes, they put a big sign on the gate saying, you know, firing today, because they still do use it for firing practice, so you certainly wouldn't choose to go then. You're not free to go until they allow you to go, if you know what I mean. But if you do go, they are not firing on that day, so you can try and forget that that's mainly what's taking place there. And it's very, very beautiful. And then the walk of the present, since I live just outside Oxford, is Watlington Hill, which is in the Chilterns. And it's ancient grass chalkland. And the wonderful thing about ancient grass chalkland is that the soil is very, very shallow, and it heats up very fast. So, in other words, lush grass can't grow there. So it's like a really, really tightly sculpted head of hair. These tiny little plants and tiny herbs, and maybe 40 different species of plant in just one square metre. Huge panorama across Oxfordshire and the Chilterns, so beautiful views, with red kites swooping above your head. I mean, don't go with a sandwich, because I think a red kite will come and grab it. But if you then move across the hill, you enter a yew wood. And obviously yew wood is, you know, yew itself is very kind of powerful, it's a totemic tree from our past. And but the way all the yew trees grow is it just looks like someone has taken a huge bit of charcoal and just scribbled across the landscape. So you enter the yew wood and it's just this knot of black lines and shapes and interwoven branches and tendrils. They're very powerful. Very uncanny. And then at the end of the wood, you emerge back out again with this enormous vista across the wild landscape.
Charlie Lee Potter, thank you very much for that interview.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Charlie Lee Potter. If you have any views on this interview, or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.